Roll 2d6, show number 2. Welcome to Roll 2d6, with Adam and Nate, a podcast about games, gaming, and gamers.
Hi to everyone, and welcome to episode 2 of Roll 2d6. I'm Adam.
And I'm Nate.
And it's been a while getting this second episode together, but we're still learning about this whole podcasting and audio recording. We should have much better sound on this episode than we did on the first episode, because we now have cool USB headset mics like Judy the Time Life Operator.
I love Judy the Time Life Operator.
I think that dates us.
I think it does. Also, thanks to everyone who enjoyed the first show enough to send us feedback either by email or by comments on the Roll2D6.com homepage. It's really great to hear that we're not talking into a vacuum and there are other people that enjoy what we have to say. Download stats are one thing, but actually hearing back from our billions and billions of listeners is great, and we thank all of you who took time to write in.
Billions and billions.
Yeah.
That was a lot of email to go through. That took me a while.
It was. That's why it took us so long to get back on the air.
That's right. I wanted to mention also a couple of other podcasts that we like. Mark Johnson's Board Games to Go podcast is one of the ones I always enjoy. His focus is on strategy board games, and he's been playing them for a long time. He covers it very well. And unlike us, he seems to have lots and lots of time for gaming and plays many, many games.
I would love to live a life just like that.
So would I. I don't have any time for that much gaming anymore.
I salute you, Mark Johnson.
Check out his podcast if you haven't already. It should be linked off of our homepage. Another one I'm a big fan of is Starting Now. This is an RPG podcast. And these are a bunch of guys that basically record their setup sessions for their RPG. And it's really fun to listen to these guys. I really enjoy it because I don't get very much RPG time these days, if any RPG time. And it's really cool to sort of sit in on their session, and they're a lot of fun to listen to. They enjoy playing with each other. They're all good friends, and it really brings me back to some of our old gaming sessions.
That's great. That sounds good. I think I'm going to check that one out. A couple of the ones that I like and would like to plug here are Geek Fu Action Grip. Can you get a better name for a podcast than Geek Fu Action Grip?
That's a great name.
That's a great name. On top of that, she's a really good writer. I really enjoy her audio essays, and I really like the variety of the show. Everything from science fiction to games, you name it, to music, it's there. The other one I really like is Dice Tower. It's sort of a hit and miss. Some of the segments I really like and think are really great, and some of them I don't mind skipping at all and moving on to the next podcast. But everyone, check out Dice Tower and Geek Fu Action Grip.
Dice Tower, one of the guys on that podcast is a professional game reviewer, right? Tom Vassell.
Yeah.
And he's done hundreds and hundreds of game reviews, and those are always very interesting to read.
Yeah, if you go to their homepage, there are big, long lists of game reviews, and it's almost like a great shopping list for people that like games.
That's true. So, Board Games to Go, Starting Now, Geek Fu Action Grip, and the Dice Tower, those should all be linked off of our Roll2D6 homepage, as well as a few others.
Yeah, I mean, there are lots of other ones we listen to. These are just a couple for today.
So, getting on to today's show, last time we went over the top 7 games that had the most impact on us before we graduated high school. And it was a lot of fun to go over these games, reminisce about them, remember some of our experiences we had at that time.
I had a great time. It made me break out some of the old books that I still had around.
That's right, and go through and read up all those spells and equipment that we always were wanting to buy for our characters. We might do some more shows like that. In fact, I think we definitely will. But today's show is going to be a little different. We're going to talk about gaming without spending too much money.
Oh, that's great, because I need to do more gaming with less money.
That's right. Actually, I need to do more gaming with less time also, but we can't cover that as much. Part one of today's show is called Operation Thrifty Grognard, and Nate will describe a free war game that we played recently.
Yeah, and we get more than we bargained for.
That's
second
right.
Part is Adam is talking about a CCG game and taking a game license where it hasn't gone before.
That's right. And now, part one.
Operation Thrifty Grognard.
Well, Adam, I had an itch.
You did?
Yeah, but it's not that kind of itch. You don't want to hear about that kind of itch. I had a gaming itch, something
okay.
That I needed scratched.
It's harder to find analgesic creams for those.
That's right. No ointment for a gaming itch. I really wanted to play a miniatures war game. And how many Warhammer 40K minis do I own?
I don't think you own any anymore.
Yeah, zero. Yeah, they're all gone. So I really wanted to play a miniatures war game, but I didn't have any minis, and I didn't have the money to go drop another 50 or 100 bucks on the miniatures, and I didn't want to spend, you know, months and months painting them. Although, if I could, I would.
You could just spray paint them all blue.
Oh, they could be just completely blue. Well, you know, I almost have
a
solution.
Dr. Manhattan
like
feel to your whole Warhammer game there.
That'd be great. Well, so I wanted to play the miniatures war game, but I wanted to do it cheap. I wanted to try to get out of it without spending a lot of money and without an incredible amount of time. So,
you're more interested in the game, as a strategic system, and not so much as looking at cool pieces moving around on the board.
Right. I probably could have done it cutting out little pieces of cardboard and using them as counters. Being an old-time Avalon Hill player, I'm used to little chits like that and using that. But this time I wanted to have it be a little bit nicer looking, but I wasn't willing to put in the time and money in order to make them look really cool. Because you know at the cons, they have those, the tables with the terrains, and they look great.
I love those really cool tabletop terrains that people bring to
the cons.
I know,
they're excellent. And you go into Games Workshop in the mall, and they've got terrains set up so that you can go and they'll try to sell you on the figures and everything with the cool terrain. I wanted to have something that looked, decent, but I was really interested in doing some strategic military stuff there. And I didn't want to get down to the level of cutting out little cardboard pieces. So I went looking for some free war game rules. And I found a place at www.freewargamesrules.co.uk.
And we'll have a link to that in the show notes, yes.
Yeah, we'll have a link to that in the show notes. And there were more free rules than you could shake a stick at there.
I can shake a stick at quite a few.
I know. You are an expert stick shaker, but let me tell you, you would be really tired by the time you got done shaking sticks and all of these rules. And so the question now was not, could I find a set of free war game rules? It was, which one of these hundreds of rules are any good and worth playing? And we'll get back to that a little bit later, about the one I picked. I picked one called Fast and Dirty. So anybody there with Google open right now can try to go find that. While we're talking about some other things. I wanted to have something like miniatures, but I didn't want to actually go spend the money for miniatures. So I needed game pieces. And so my solution was the dollar store. I went to the
dollar... I love the dollar store.
Isn't the dollar store great? You can get everything from dollar motor oil to...
I think the dollar motor oil was used when we went there.
I think it is. But they have anything there. And the toy section of my local dollar store is really cool. They have a lot of interesting stuff there, and it comes through fairly regularly.
I think you buy more things for yourself at the dollar toy store than you do for your kids.
I do. My wife sends me to the dollar store to go get something, like for the kids, and I come back with a whole sack full of stuff for me and one little thing for them. So I spend $1 on my kids and $10 on me. So what I did is I... went and found Army Men at the dollar store. So
all right.
50 of them for a dollar.
Wow, that's 2 cents each.
It is. It's enough for about a platoon. So 48 soldiers, 3 or 4 squads, of soldiers there for only a dollar. And they happened to have green ones, and they had beige ones. They had red ones that looked like firemen, and blue ones that looked like policemen. And I picked up a couple of those just in case, so I could eventually have the battle of the soldiers versus policemen, or the fireman from Altair 7.
Battle of the emergency services.
That's right. If this had been an actual emergency, the tone you just... So that wasn't a serious outlay for money to do that. I spent about $2 rather than spending $50 to try to get a platoon's worth of soldiers' worth of minis.
That's cool. And,
yeah.
And I saw those dollar army men, and they were not all... Some of them were defective.
Yes, a large number of them. I wasn't able to actually use all 50 of them. A lot of them either didn't have feet or didn't have arms or were, sort of
that
contorted.
That would reduce their effectiveness as a soldier, I would think.
That's right. That would keep them out of the draft, I think. They wouldn't be good soldiers without their legs and arms and things. So, yeah, the dollar store minis. If you have a choice in either going to the dollar store to get those army men, or to go to Toys R Us. I went and later picked up some ones at Toys R Us, and they had a much better production rate. So they They were much better. More of them stood up.
They were higher quality. But what was the? How much did
they
those
were higher
ones
quality?
Cost?
Those were $2.50 for 50 of them.
Wow! So literally,
so
two and a half times.
That's right. 2.5 times the cost, and still we're at about a nickel a piece.
Wow.
Yeah. Take that. You know, take that, Warhammer. Nickel a piece. And so while I was there, I also decided to pick up. I was looking through, and I saw that they had model train track there. They had like 10 sets of, you know, 6 to 8 inches long runs of train track. So I bought a couple of those so that I could run a train track through a scenario. And
these are ones that are about half an inch wide? Or
yeah,
inch
I think they're
wide.
HO scale. Is
I don't
that?
Know what the it's, scales I, are.
I actually looked it up, and they're a real scale, and they're about, yeah, they're about a half an inch, maybe 3/4 of an inch wide.
But they were a good size to throw down with the army men and make train tracks going across our terrain.
Right, right. They actually looked like they were in fairly decent scale for that. I also used, I had some old Ral Partha plastic miniatures that I bought, oh, I guess maybe it's been 15 years ago now, of Battletech guys. So I wanted some powered armor guys. This was going to be a science fiction war game, so I wanted some powered armor in addition to the armor, the army men. And so I dug those out of my closet. And they're Battletech figures, and they are slightly taller, slightly wider, a little bit bigger than the army men. So they look kind of like an army man.
I thought they worked really well with the army men by being slightly larger. The humanoid battle mechs really look like a guy in powered armor if you scale them down to the same size as a guy.
Right, right. So, you know, I didn't have any of the weird ones like the Mad Cat or something that were essentially two legs and a gun platform. These were the humanoid looking ones like the Atlas and a couple of them that you know, that look like people. And I wanted some minis or things for mortar squads, heavy weapons squads, and so in the dollar store again, I went down the aisle and found they had some die-cast metal army tanks and helicopters and vehicles and APCs and all sorts of cool stuff like that. So I spent another couple dollars buying a few of those that would end up being mortar squads, they, you know, like a tank.
You're becoming more and more of a spendthrift as you,
I am.
You go through this story. Dollar here, dollar
there.
Oh,
dollar here, dollar there. I'm just throwing it away.
You're going to be up to $10.
That's right. Almost. Okay, here's the last major purchase that I made for this thing is I went and bought felt at Walmart. I bought a couple yards of felt.
Also known as Muppet skin.
Yes. You know, I kind of think that if I could have, I would have gone to go hunt the wild Muppet myself and skin it. I just don't have time to go on that sort of safari looking
Muppet
for...
Muppet habitats have decreased a lot lately.
That's right. You can only find them in certain urban areas in New York, and then you can get to the native Sesame Street land and skin and kill the Muppets for it. So I used this felt for the terrain on the ground. Yeah, I didn't make a nice terrain. Yeah, it didn't really have levels. Yeah, it was my living room floor, but I was able to cut out areas of rough terrain.
You have a nice green rug. It looks like scrub.
It's a nice green rug. Yeah, it's sort of flat scrub, and I cut out some blue felt for river, so I had river and had water features, and I had a couple areas of rough terrain for people to move through. And you donated to me a piece of foam core.
Yes, a big chunk of half-inch thick foam core I had left over from a previous project.
Yeah, and so we cut that up into strips and used that, stuck it together with toothpicks. I know, it sounds really weird. We've got pictures up on the website. You can take a look. And we stuck it together in order to make bombed-out buildings, walls, you know, other sorts of line-of-sight blocking features.
Yes, we don't want our army's fighting on a featureless plane.
Right, right. That may be okay, you know, if we had a... You know, the fighting on the plains of Cockrafoon or something. But right now, we were going to have... You're going to make people move around rather than sit toe-to-toe and fire at each other.
That'll be part of my Battles of Tron war game.
Oh, there you go.
Come up with later.
So, here we are. That was the last major purchase that we went through. Well, we made some modifications to the army men because they were... Some of them, like we said, they didn't stand up very well. And then once you put them on my living room carpet, they really didn't stand up very well. Some of them... couldn't stand up at all. So we put cardstock bases on the bottom. We cut out little 1.5 inch by 1.5 inch squares that were business cards. We cut the business cards in half, and so we at our work, they issue us like 500 business cards, and because I'm not in sales and I don't deal with people and I don't have to hand out my business cards to people, I think I still have 493 business cards sitting on my desk.
I have about 490 myself.
Yes. And you've worked there twice as long as I have. So that just shows you the rate that we go through these. And so I took a big stack of them and cut them in half and used them as additional game bases for some of these figures and put them on with sticky tack.
That's right. We stuck all the army men onto sticky tack. So even the ones that had bent bases or bent ankles so they couldn't quite stand up, they were still able to stand up.
That's right. You put a wide enough base on them, and that also helped with the rule set. It also helped to put some bases on these figures because army men have, shall we say, strange shaped bases. They're less than regular.
Yeah. Well, it was harder to tell which direction they were pointing. Well, not that that mattered for this game.
Yeah, it didn't matter for this game, but it could have. All right. So here we are, my living room rug, and we had all this felt on the ground for the terrain. We had our guys held up by bases. We had divided up into a couple of platoon versus platoon. So I think we maybe had about 40 soldiers on each side.
I don't even think it was that many. I think it was more like 20 on each side.
Was it 20? Okay. Then it was... We only did two squads.
Two squads of about 8 each.
Yeah, we had 2 squads. No, actually, you had 3 squads because you had a mortar team.
Oh, that's right.
But you started them far enough from the battle that they didn't engage until the end of battle.
They never made it into the battle.
They never made it in there. So I needed to get out the rules. And the rules that I picked, like I said, were fast and dirty. And I'm going to refer to it now as FAD because... Well, it's easier for me to say, FAD. I wanted a science fiction one, so I looked at some other ones that are there on the Free War Games Rules website, like Sci-Fight, Sci-Fi Skirmish, Street Fight, and I looked at FAD. And the other systems were good, and they were interesting in their own right, but they didn't have quite the abstraction level that I wanted to play.
I think they were more individual soldier-level combat, isn't that right?
Right. For every individual soldier, you kept track of their stats, even if their stats were only one or two numbers. And every round of firing, each one of those soldiers could pick a different target or fire a certain way.
And you wanted to go up at least one step in abstraction and sort of do squad level.
Right, right. I wanted to do squad level. I wanted to have my entire squad acting as a single cohesive unit. And not have and not have individual guys, mostly because of the scale. I mean, 20 or 30 guys, if you're making 20 to hit rolls or 30 to hit rolls every single turn,
that can get unwieldy.
Yeah.
But with the squad level combat, we could have, once we knew the rules, I think we could have easily commanded 2 or 3 times as many squads as we did.
Easily, we could have easily done an entire platoon each rather than just 2 or 3 squads. So I really liked it. I really liked FAD because it had that extra level of abstraction. The firing was at the squad level, and if your squads were big enough and your troops were experienced enough, you could split that into fire section level. But still, that's more manageable than, you know, each individual soldier.
I think that it worked out really well. You move the squads as a squad. They have to stay within a certain distance of each other or else they lose their morale. And they get certain fire penalties and other penalties.
Right.
And, I thought it worked out really well.
Yeah, for the level of what we wanted to play, it worked out really well that way. One of the other things that I really liked about the FAD system that the other ones didn't quite do is it had a more extensive morale and troop quality and troop determination rules that the other systems may not have had. All of them have some sort of morale check or whatnot. That's sort of basic. But this one kept track of, you know, your squads, how committed are they to their goals, to their orders? You know, what's their determination level? At what point do they break and run? Or at what point do they have to make another morale check? Or, you know, how willing are they to stand up and fight to the death or whatnot?
Yeah, I thought that was really cool because you could have troops that were, you know, very desperate, or even troops that were like zombie troops or undead troops, which are willing to fight to the death, and or human troops that are not as committed and would have less morale.
Right, right. I also like the troop quality system. They had, green conscripts, regular soldiers, veterans, and elites, and each one of those conferred some sort of extra benefit on the field. For example, an elite squad, they could work farther apart, they could have more separate targets, more possible targets in any particular turn, they were less likely to,
to break when they were under heavy stress or under heavy fire.
I thought that was a really good system, because it really, the main thing that it affected for me during the game was how far apart the individual soldiers in the squad could be.
Right.
Because you're moving them together, but they have to stay a certain number of inches away from each or close to each other.
Right.
And the more experienced soldiers can be farther away, and I think, I don't remember the rules exactly, but I think they were less affected by taking casualties to their squad.
Yes, they were less easily affected by casualties, and they also had sort of a longer range that they could use to fire. So your distance wasn't weapons based as much as it was based on your troop quality. So green troops that haven't done anything are really ineffective at long distance combat because, they can't aim their rifles, they're not sure, they wait till people get right up on them before they fire, and so their effective range is shorter than the elite ones. So,
and this is sort of assuming that all troops have the same basic combat assault rifle.
Right, that if you're fielding a squad of men, chances are they have a general basic equipment. Now, there is different equipment. Certain weapons do have longer range than other ones, but it's sort of a multiplier based on the experience level. I did have to do a little bit of restructuring with some of the rules. I am by trade an instructional designer, a technical writer, and so every time I read a document, the first thing that goes through my head, and this is an occupational hazard, is I think, how would I rearrange this and organize this for most effective pedagogical use in order to teach people and best explain the concepts?
I remember when we first played Shadowrun First Edition, you had quite a lot of problems with the organization of that rulebook, and that was even before you had this job.
It is. Maybe that was sort of a foreshadowing of things to come. But yeah, so this is one of the problems that I often run into with rules and rule sets by both professional groups and amateur people and professional people who've put things out on the web for free or whatever.
So since this was a free war game that was just put out on the web, I imagine and this and all the others, you had a lot of problems with the way the rules were organized.
Well, yeah.
I don't want to sound too bad, because people are putting these out of the joy of their heart in writing a war game.
Right, out of the goodness of their heart. And it was a really great service to have these rules and have them play tested and everything. I just needed, for my own brain, I needed it slightly reorganized. So I consolidated some of the modifier charts. It was missing a turn sequence chart. I had to sort of tease out from the game what was the turn sequence, and so I made a separate turn sequence chart, and I put it all together and reformatted it and sent the author a copy of it.
I think he was pretty appreciative of your brand new reorganized PDF of his rule system.
Yeah, it sounded like, I got a reply from him, and he sounded very positive about it, and I can't put that one up on the web because I don't have permission to redistribute his work.
Did he put it up on his site?
Yeah. I have not seen it on his site. Okay. I haven't gone back to check since then, but I did check soon after I sent it to him and it didn't go up, but I'd have to look. So I did have to restructure it. So with all of that, we were ready to play. And I really liked, in the gameplay, the use of the troop psychology. I liked the abstraction level. I liked the fact that troops under fire took cover. And sometimes you miss that in a war game. Some of the war games assume that troops, they're under fire and they just continue to, to plug on through and move where you tell them to move and fire at what you tell them to fire at. And this, it almost seems as if you were giving them all orders and suggestions and they were having to carry them out because they were constrained by the effects of the battlefield.
That I thought was a really cool aspect of this system, is that when your troops are being shot at, they're considered to be under fire, and so you put a little indicator next to their squad. We used colored poker chips for this.
Yeah.
And when you're under fire, it's harder to do stuff because your guys are ducking, they're having to avoid being shot at, and it makes it harder to fire at other things. And then when two other squads are firing at you, then you're considered pinned, and
right,
that gives you even more penalties. And
that's right.
I thought that was really cool, because when I was firing at your squad, or maybe you were firing at mine, I forget, and they were pinned, and I basically could hardly do anything because
right.
My guys were so afraid to move. And I think that was one of the other benefits of having experienced soldiers. Is that
yes.
not true? that
had a chance to.
They had less penalties from being pinned by enemy fire.
Right. They were. You know. Although yes, they did have effects under enemy fire. They just had different sorts of effects, or the effects were mitigated somewhat by their quality level. And the other thing is this really helped battlefield tactics go on, because you couldn't pin down anybody without coming at them from two different directions under fire.
That's right. The fire, in order to pin another enemy squad, the fire had to be coming from a certain angle apart.
Right. They had to come from a certain angle apart, in which case, so you're cutting off, you know, areas of retreat and blocking. And so you really had to decide, well, where is my squad going to be, and how am I going to keep them together, and how am I going to fit them around this rough terrain, and how am I still going to keep them, you know, from having to make the morale check, from being broken apart. And so it was really nice to be able to see, not only on, you know, on the squad level, but a larger battlefield level, you know, where am I going to take cover, how am I going to flank the oncoming troops, how am I going to try to pin them down and keep them from, you know, crossing this certain area. So I really like that. Some of the other strengths that I thought were good that we didn't use. I mean, we used power armor, like I said. We used power armor rules. And this particular rule set has rules for vehicles, tanks, power armor, special troop traits like zombie troops and robot troops, and other options for more cinematic play as opposed to more realistic play. And so there were a lot of really good things there, and there's way more info there in the system than you could use in any one particular battle. You'd have to have a really massive battle in order to use all of the different things there.
I don't think that would be possible, because there were like 20 different types of troops. Oh, that's zombie true. Troops and insect troops and human troops and zealot troops and all these different things.
That would have been nigh unto impossible to use them all. So it has a lot of replay value.
And we would have needed like 12 different colors of army men for that.
Right. And, you know, and I have since bought little plastic spiders and little plastic insects from like skee-ball supply stores or whatnot, and I'm going to put them on bases, and we're going to have bugs versus humans
cool.
too.
So it'll be like the really low-cost version of Starship Troopers.
Yeah, without having to buy those Starship Trooper minis that are out now. there were some drawbacks or things that I would change or do differently. Some of the drawbacks of the rules is there were no terrain effects. I created the terrain section that you saw because I really thought that there have to be terrain modifiers. Terrain has to make a difference.
Yeah, that seems like a major oversight, but it would be something that would be fairly easy to add. And you did come up with some good off-the-cuff rules, I think, that worked.
Yeah, and if I were doing it again, I would actually tweak those a little bit, because now they've been play-tested once. I think I'd like to go back one more time and tweak those. The other cons were the rules were a little unclear. There was no turn sequence summary, but I was able to piece one together for myself.
Although if he posts your PDF, that will no longer be a problem.
Well, maybe we can talk to him. I'd like to have him do that. The other con is the fire still felt a little too indirect. Now, I said I wanted to make it indirect by having squad-level fire.
And by indirect, you mean not like artillery-type indirect. You mean...
Yeah, right.
The fire in this game was not... I roll a d20 to see if I hit. Oh, and I hit, and I do damage. That was not the way it was.
No, it was not like that at all. It was, you had a certain number of troops, and you would designate a firing target. You'd figure out how many targets they could have, and you'd pick one of those, and they would generate a fire effect. And this fire effect was a number, and it wasn't dice roll or anything, but you had this number, and then the fire effect amount would give you chances to generate damage. So it would be essentially the number of times you get to roll your 1d20 and do damage or something like that. So first step is target acquisition and then generating a fire effect, and that depends on your troop quality, what sort of weapons you have, and what sort of tactics you're using. Then you get a certain number of damage chances. Then each one of those rolls goes in to see if they actually hit or cause some sort of damage. And if they cause some sort of damage, they get to get mitigated by the other squad, and then on top of that, the receiving squad, the one receiving damage, gets to now designate the damage among the troops however they see. And so you're looking at a six-step system to go from bang to fall down in the mud.
Yeah, it was. I thought that slowed the game down a little bit too, and also the fact that I couldn't really, during the course of the game we played, internalize it enough to be able to estimate when my troops fired at another squad if I would have a decent chance to hit or how much damage I would do.
Right. You know, we might be able to get that internalization by further play, but
yes,
it just wasn't immediately obvious. There wasn't an easy number to crunch to figure out, am I going up against too many guys here, or is this, you know, equally stacked? And so that was a little indirect. I'm not sure what we could do to fix that. Like I said, part of the joy is that this is a slightly abstract system in a way, and I don't want to get rid of that abstraction. I just want to cut down that number of steps from bang to fall in the mud.
That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah. And the other great pro I liked about it is I like the fact that it scales well. And if we did it again, I would like to do a bigger battle.
Yeah, we could definitely control three or four squads each, I think.
Right, rather than just the two or three that we had. The other thing that I'd like to do is I think my living room floor, as fun as it was to play on my living room floor, I think I would want to... It was a pretty big thing. To put it in the scale of the army men, it was pretty big. So I'd like to maybe use 15mm figures from the hobby store, little plastic 15mm.
I think you have like an 8-foot by 8-foot rug, right?
Yeah,
the entirety of.
Yes, we used the entire 8-foot by 8-foot rug. And so I'd like to maybe cut the scale down by 1/4 and play on my dining room table now and maybe, just change the scale of the game from inches to centimeters or to quarter inches or whatever.
Oh, yeah, we could definitely do that.
So that was it. So for a grand total.
There was one other thing that wanted to mention, another major con of the game, is that there's no internal balancing mechanism.
Oh, absolutely. I'm sorry I forgot that. That's another thing. Is the author himself said, and I respect his position on this, is he doesn't like the point-based systems for balance. He doesn't like saying, well, I'm going to build my 500-point Uber army using the best rule lawyering that I can to get the most firepower for the least number of points. So he was totally turned off to that. And because of that, it's not that he just didn't use a point system. He didn't use a internal balancing mechanism at all.
So there was no way to say, if I have this squad with these weapons, how many guys can you have to balance that out?
Right. There was no immediately obvious way to do that. So I took some, silly wild-ass guesses and tried to come up with something that I thought might be fair. And then on top of that, the scenario itself required an attacking squad to be a stronger force than the defending squad. So I not only had to figure out what was balanced, I had to figure out what was unbalanced in the attacking squad and the attacking force's favor. So if you were to do this, yourself, you'll need to come up with some sort of internal balancing, unless you just want to do the everyone has the same weapons, same armor, and same number of troops, and then you're pretty sure that they're balanced.
The author just recommended coming to a gentleman's agreement before the battle and saying, "I have this and you have that, and now let's fight." But that doesn't always work. So
I find that might cause more fights over the game table than the actual battle itself.
That's possible.
Anyway, so for a grand total.
What was your total cost here?
It was $12 and some odd cents. It was a total of $12. I was able to play a really fun, really good, large-scale miniatures war game and had a great time doing it.
I agree. That was a lot of fun. I didn't do any of the shopping for it, but I'm sure you had fun doing that. And it was a lot of fun. I would definitely play it again.
Yeah. So that's my scratching my gaming itch with the FAD system. Now, we'll have, like I said, the free wargamesrules.co.uk in the show notes. Also, the FAD, Fast and Dirty Wargames Rules homepage and their Yahoo group. And also, as a bonus to you, a bunch
for
of
no
pictures.
Extra cost.
And for no extra cost, some Flickr pictures. Some pictures we took and we put up on Flickr of the battle. So you'll get to see not only, like, for example, my feet on the living room floor measuring things.
I might have to blur those out.
Yeah, those are identifying features. But you'll get to see, the figures and the battlefield, and so that will be there in the show notes as well.
You too will get to see army men on a green rug.
That's right.
Battling it out with each other.
Army men on a green rug. Can you think of a more exciting set of pictures? I don't think I can.
So that was the FAD system, and I think we had a great time playing it.
We did.
When is ACCG not ACCG?
Well, we were talking about this earlier, and I want you to answer the question, because we've led along our listeners now. When is a CCG, a collectible card game, not a CCG?
Well, in order to answer that, I'm going to go into a lot of long, convoluted history, and then I'll explain this.
Wow, it's like school, but about games.
You're really selling this segment. Okay, so this is a segment about a CCG, And before all the CCG haters turn this off, please bear with me for a moment, and I'll explain why this game I'm going to talk about does not seem like a CCG to us. Now, I'm a recovering Magic player myself, so let me explain why I like this game. And before I do that, let me go into the things that we don't like about CCGs. Now, why did we become disillusioned with Magic the Gathering and with CCGs in general over time?
I can tell you why I got disillusioned with it.
Why is that?
I hated the fact that my ability to play was hampered by how much money I was willing to spend. There was always the 12-year-old across the table from me who had a much greater disposable income, who'd spent four times as much on cards, and therefore anything he played just beat me no matter what.
It's funny that the 12-year-olds had more disposable income than we did in our 20s.
I think that's amazing, but it's true.
But yes, that was definitely number one, the collectible aspect, is you had to spend a lot of money, or at least there was a feeling that you had to spend a lot of money to have fun and to play a good game, and the feeling that someone else who spent more money than you would have a better deck and be more successful.
But let me just say that if I had a CCG, I would love this aspect of it, because it would make me a lot of money. So I see why they do it, and I see why they think it's great. I can just tell you that from my point of view, I'd like to avoid that.
Yes. And the other thing, which is a more subtle aspect of why we had a problem with, or why I had a problem with CCGs, is the fact that you need all the players in your group to have a buy-in in order to play a CCG. Now, this is very different from like a typical box game that I buy at a game store. If I go see a cool box game somewhere, I can buy it, I can bring it to our game group the next time we get together, and we can all play it. But if I see a cool new CCG, it's not just me that has to buy cards. I have to convince you, and more than just you, if I want to play against more than two people.
Right, and this actually bit our gaming group in the ass itself, because I was out of the country when Magic first came out.
That's right.
And so when I returned to the country, Magic was in full swing, and everybody had a set of Magic cards, and everyone had a big box of them. And everyone was saying, oh, come on, Nate, go ahead and play. And I'm like, yeah, but now I have to spend like $40 of my own to play a game that you already own. And
That's right.
And so I never ended up buying it, and I just watched everybody else play.
Well, with Magic the Gathering, the buy-in aspect was not as big a deal because everyone was playing Magic the Gathering. And so everyone had bought in. But there was lots of other CCGs that came out at that time. So let me go in. So how do we get around these two major drawbacks of CCGs, which is the collectible aspect and the buy-in aspect? So how do I turn a CCG essentially into a box game? And the answer is, one way I could do it is buy a whole bunch of cards myself and make a bunch of decks and bring my big box of cards to the gaming session. And now we can treat it as a box game.
Now, you don't want to do this with a currently shipping game, though, because
That's right. Can
get prohibitively expensive.
Definitely. If I made, you know, enough cards to make several good decks, this could be, you know, upwards of $100.
There's no board game I'd pay $100 for.
There's very few that I would play, especially an unproven game that I'm introducing to the game group for the first time. So how do we reduce this cost in order to make it as inexpensive as a box game? So in order to answer this question, let me go a little bit into the history of CCGs.
Oh, all right.
So we all remember, well, you don't remember because you were
out of the country.
the rest of us all remember when Magic the Gathering came out in 1993.
And that's like when everyone became Magic the Gathering pod people, right?
That's right.
They were completely taken over mind and body by
everywhere you went, Magic. Gamers were playing Magic the Gathering. It was very popular. Everyone who was a gamer bought cards. There was lots of people to play with everywhere you go. I myself bought tons and tons of Magic cards. And I still have them in my gamer closet at home.
I think they take up half your gamer closet.
Well, they take up more space than I would like them to take up. I keep meaning to sell them, but I just haven't gotten around to it.
Oh, but you'd have to put them all in little card condoms.
And I'd have to sell them all individually on eBay. Please buy my beta land.
That's not worth it.
So a lot of us, when this came out, we were sort of in awe of it as a success of game design, since this was a new genre of game that we hadn't seen before. We all thought it was a lot of fun.
Right.
And also as a success of marketing and as a business model.
Absolutely.
Because we all were hooked on buying these cards, and it, you know, becomes sort of an addiction.
It's the money that eventually bought TSR and all sorts
exactly.
of other stuff.
Exactly. So, those of us who were around for those first few years of Magic, we may also remember that soon after it came out, lots and lots of other companies decided to try to jump into this market at the same time, and they all came out with lots of other collectible card games during the, like, 93 to 97 or 98 period.
Right.
And some of these were good. Some of them were pretty clear attempts, mainly just to cash in on the trend with little thought put into design or artwork.
I've seen those.
I'm specifically thinking of Spellfire.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you ever played that one, but
I never played it, but I saw the cards and they were just...
It was all just recycled art from the TSR vaults.
Right.
Anyway, and the game itself was not that hot. So my theory is that during that time, between like 93 to 2000, lots of CCGs came out, and that not all of these games may have been bad, just that some of them were released at the wrong time when the market was flooded. And in such a flooded market, I think there must have been games that came out and could not get a critical mass of players going in order to keep the game going and keep it in print.
So they sort of languished just from lack of attention.
That's right, because everyone was playing Magic. There was, you know, if you launched a game in 1995, there was 20 other CCGs that came out in 1995.
And then you were bit by the buy-in thing and people feeling like they had to spend $20 or $40 on their own set of cards, and who's going to spend $20 or $40 on Magic and on Spellfire and on Vampire and on all some of these other CCGs?
Exactly. So some of these did become successful, but my theory is that there are ones that did not become successful, not because they were a bad game, but because they were released at the wrong time.
That is a great theory.
As a result of this theory, I like to play out-of-print CCGs to see if any of them are any fun.
Ah, yes,
and the other advantage is that out-of-print CCGs are really cheap.
They are.
You can usually get them on eBay for way cheap. Now, all that being said, I'm going to finally say what CCG I'm going to talk about, which is Star Trek the Card Game. Don't sing too many notes of that or we have to pay for it.
Okay.
So this was published by Fleer Skybox in 1996. So this came out during a year when lots and lots of CCGs came out.
Right, and Fleer actually had a lot of CCGs that failed. They had a Marvel Superheroes CCG that didn't go anywhere.
They did.
So they had a couple of them that went. I mean, they've made a lot of money in sports collectible cards, so this was their trying to get into game collectible cards. And you're saying that this game didn't fail because it was bad. It failed just because of market saturation.
Well, I'm not going to say whether it was bad or not yet. I'll get to that point a little later.
All right.
But it did come out when the market was saturated. This was a game based on the original Star Trek series. There was another Star Trek CCG that came out in 1994, 2 years earlier than this. This was the Decipher one. Based on Next Generation, but this one was based on the original series from the 60s. Now, when this first came out in 1996, I saw it in a game store and I had bought a starter deck of it, mainly because I'm a big Star Trek geek and I buy all kinds of Star Trek things. And I thought it might be cool and I would at least get some cool cards out of it that I could scan in to get desktop pictures.
Oh, all right.
So I looked at the cards. I thought, oh, this is kind of cool. But I never played it. I never got anyone else to buy cards. Right. And it sat on one of the shelves of my game closet for many, many years. And then, just about a year ago, I was searching for Star Trek stuff on eBay because I'm a big Star Trek geek.
That's right.
And I found that you could get entire boxes of boosters for this game for less than $10.
Oh, wow.
So, you know,
An entire box of boosters for less than $10.
It doesn't have to be that good to be worth, you know, $9.95.
Right.
So, and I just did a search on eBay today, and you can still find boxes of boosters for about the same price.
Wow.
So I bought a box of boosters, and I also bought a box of starter decks, and found that it is a fun game for that price.
So probably a total outlay of $20.
It was about $20 for a box of boosters and a box of starters, yes. That's not counting the starter I originally bought in 1996, which I'd bought at full price, which was probably like $12. So this one starter.
We'll chalk that one up to youthful indiscretion.
That cost more than my entire box of boosters I bought later. So now this is a fun game. Let me go over the way the gameplay works. The two players, you take turns being the current player and the opponent. And when you're the current player, you're trying to go through an entire episode of the show. And you do this by playing three cards, which are the mission card, the plot card, and the discovery card.
Yeah, so the mission is like the setup to what it is they're out to do, and the plot is the twist that happens in the middle of the, you know, or the meat of the episode, and the discovery is how they manage to come out of the
the episode.
That's right. It's the big denouement.
Yes.
So in the center of the table, you have the big three, what we call the big three. And these are Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. And then you have another card which represents the Enterprise. And these are personnel that are available to everyone who's playing the game.
See, this I think was one of the best things about this particular game is that, you know, like in the Star Wars collectible card game, which I bought way too many of, everyone was trying to get the, you know, the Darth, or I guess the first printing, the Darth Vaders, the Han Solos. They were trying to go for the big name people because those were the really powerful cards. And in this, the big name people are available to everybody. They're common. They're part of the main deck.
Yeah, that was the difference, is that in the Decipher Star Trek game, and there's also the Decipher Star Wars game, they made all the characters that anyone had ever heard of be rares. Right. So Han Solo was rare, C-3PO was rare. But in this, Kirk, Spock, and McCoy are in the fixed set that is available in every starter. So everyone has Kirk, Spock, and McCoy.
What would Star Trek be without Kirk, Spock, and McCoy?
It would be a little less interesting. At least the old show.
At least the old show.
It would be The Adventures of Sulu. Hey, oh, actually, yeah, I would watch that.
Yeah, I'd watch that one too.
So,
The Adventures of Lieutenant Commander Gary Mitchell, or something like that. That would be slightly less interesting.
So, these three are sitting in the middle of the table. You also have another card which represents the Enterprise itself, or the rest of the staff of the Enterprise.
Right.
And when it's your turn, you can play one other character to the table, and these are going to be other minor characters that appeared in some Star Trek episode or another. And
like Gary Mitchell.
Gary Mitchell. I'm looking through some cards right now. Lieutenant Leslie, Lieutenant Lindstrom, Lieutenant Esteban Rodriguez. I don't know who most of these people are.
Yeah,
but
I barely recognize them. So
every once in a while, when I watch the old show, though, I do see these guys, and I'm like, hey, I have that card.
Yeah. It brings new enjoyment to watching the show.
It does. Because I know exactly what his stats are when I see him on screen.
All right.
So you can play one character card, and then you're trying to get through your mission. Now, you have to play three cards in order, which I mentioned earlier, the mission card, the plot card, and the discovery card, which represent like the first act, the meat of the episode, and the denouement, or the twist ending. So after you play each of these cards, the opponent can play a challenge card, and this is going to be some antagonist to the Kirk and the others that happened in one of the episodes.
So you'll have, you know, Khan or a Klingon commander. Or
the guy who's black on one side of his head and white on the other.
Yeah, whatever his name was.
Or one of Mudd's women.
Oh, yeah.
Or the android duplicate.
I want Mudd's women to oppose me.
They wouldn't have any opposition from me. Oh, I even have my Khan card right here.
Hey, all right.
So I would put down one of my mission cards, like, for example, the mission from the Devil in the Dark episode. The USS Enterprise is summoned to Janus 6, where something is killing colony miners.
And at this point, someone gets a chance to put down a card. The person across from you gets to play something else.
Play a challenge card, yes. Yeah. So they would put down, here's another random challenge, they would put down the Romulan commander. For some reason, he's interested in Janus 6 and wants us to stop. Doesn't want Kirk to succeed in his mission there.
Right.
So they put down the challenge card. Each of the characters has a rating in three areas, combat, logic, and humanity. And so to resolve the challenges that the opponent puts down, you look at the type of challenge it is, which will be something like ambush, befuddle, enigma, capture, outwit. And you compare certain ratings on the challenge card to the ratings of people in your landing party.
Okay.
And then each side draws a number of cards out of their deck. And each card has one of these little symbols in the corner, so this is used as a randomizing technique. So if this is a combat challenge, then you draw the number of cards equal to your combat statistic. You count up to see how many combat icons you got and see who won the challenge. And if your characters lose the challenge, then they could be neutralized for the rest of the episode, they could be captured by the opposing player, or they can even be permanently killed. And I remember a game that you and I played, which just so happened that Kirk and Spock both got killed during the course of an episode, and so the show became The Adventures of McCoy. Space Doctor.
Space Doctor. McCoy, Space Doctor.
And so he had to finish the rest of the missions by himself. Now, each of the plot, mission, and discovery cards you play provide a certain number of experience points, and if you get through the whole episode, pass all the challenges, then you get those number of XPs, and you can distribute them amongst all the characters who participated in that mission, including the big three. And the winner is the first person to get 25 points of experience on all of their characters. But you can count the XP on your characters as well as the ones on the big three in the middle.
Right. So if they're in the big three in the middle, both players can count that experience.
Yes, those are like shared victory points. Now, why would you want to do this? Because these big three have special abilities that can only be used if you spend the XP that are on them. So even though it will help you, if I put XP on there, it'll help me later on. So it's kind of a gamble to do that, but it usually works out. And you do want to use those special abilities because they're very helpful.
Right.
Now, because I like Star Trek so much, I found this to be a very fun game, just from being a Star Trek game. Now, the strategy in it isn't particularly deep.
I don't think so. It is fun. It's fast moving.
It's fun. You've got all these Star Trek characters. But I couldn't get my head behind the premise here. I'm controlling a bunch of minor characters from the Enterprise. You're controlling a bunch of minor characters from the Enterprise. What do we represent? Are we different factions of crewmen on the Enterprise? They're trying to get more training than each other.
Right. They're competing against each other or something.
I'm the class of 2453 at Starfleet Academy, and you're in the class of 2452. I don't get it. So this didn't make sense to me. So instead of playing it that way, we play this as a humorous game in the vein of like Shea Geek or Munchkin.
Yes.
And in fact, we call this the Desilu Productions game.
Yes.
That being the production company that produced Star Trek.
So each one of us are trying to produce our own episodes of the show, or we're writers, or
we play as agents for these small-time character actors that are, and we're trying to get them screen time on Star Trek
right.
by pitching episode ideas to the producers.
Right. So the XP isn't experience as much as it's screen time.
Exactly. So, you know, when I start an episode with a mission card, you know, I can imagine I'm chewing a cigar in a smoke-filled conference room and say, "Okay, here's the pitch." Kirk Spock,
Spock and McCoy, and
Lieutenant D'Amato beamed down to an Earth-like world inhabited only by children.
And then I put down, yeah, but you know, it would be better if Khan showed up.
And then he puts down the Khan card. That's great. Brilliant.
Brilliant, I love it.
And then Talosians appear. So then they
Kirk
resolve the challenge.
And teaches us to laugh at love and life again, and he defeats the Talosians.
That's right. And so I think this makes a lot of fun. And if the characters get killed, then it means it's the negotiating power of the other agents getting your characters written out of the episode.
That's right. Sort of like the real-life you know, issues that happened on the show.
And if Kirk gets killed, then it's Shatner quitting the show in disgust after his character is written into a corner. And each card has flavor text on it, so you read that out loud as you play it. It's a lot of fun. And we really like combining the bits of various episodes together. It's like Star Trek Mad Libs. I think it's great.
It is. It's a lot of fun. One of the things that I really liked about it was the fact that, well, being a big Star Trek geek myself, too, and who listening to this is not, but I'm sure there are a few people that aren't, but just sort of reliving some of these episodes, recognizing them come up, and seeing like the Mad Lib quality of starting out with, going to the Cage Planet, and the next thing they know, they have to rescue Edith Keeler on the Cage Planet, and you're like, oh, it's all sort of crooked, and then having your minor characters step up to the plate and do something interesting instead of trying to have them fall back on the big three, because the big three are specialists in their area in combat, logic, and humanity. So chances are they can do a really good job of fixing the episode. But that doesn't help your minor characters, and your minor characters hoarding their own experience helps put experience on your plate to win the game. And so
yes,
you want to get these people screen time. You want to get these minor characters out there. I want Gary Mitchell to be out there adventuring with these guys to get XP so that I can win the game for myself. And I want to have a little bit of XP on the big three so that they can, you know, they can use their special powers when I get into a, you know, get into a jam. But having that all mixed up and having it jumbled together was one of my favorite bits of playing this.
I think it's great. And then the other thing, we mentioned that when you put down a mission plot or discovery card, you have to read the flavor text out loud. So
right.
the captain gives the crew shore leave on an Earth-like planet. That would be a mission. Now, if you have to play a mission plot and discovery on your turn. You have to do this.
Right.
But if you don't have one in your hand, then
because you may not have drawn one, and
you may not have drawn one. Yes, you don't. You may not have a mission card. So what do you do then? Well, you have on the side of the table these three cards, which are the default mission, default plot, and default discovery.
Right, which you can put down at any point in there, instead of putting down one from your hand, either if you don't have one or something.
That's right, and these don't produce very much XP for your players, but they're there if you need it.
Right.
So. And with these, they just have a generic thing which comes from the opening. So on the default mission card, it says, these are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise.
Right.
And on the default plot, it says, its mission, to seek out new life and new civilizations. And the default discovery says, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Right.
So we'll be playing this game, and we'll play a mission and play a plot. And then I realize I don't have a discovery card in my hand. So I'm like, okay. And then what do they find out at the end of the mission? I put down the default.
Yeah.
They find out that they've boldly gone where no one has gone before.
Sort of a cop-out ending. That I think I've actually seen those episodes where they seem like they're having a good episode, and it gets to the end, and it just sort of peters out with, yeah, okay, let's wrap this up. It's time to go home.
And let's wrap this up. Let's all have a laugh at Spock, and then let's warp out.
That's right.
Yeah, so... The default cards always give us a good laugh, and you can, and when you're playing it as the agents, you know, you can pretend that it's just a poorly written first act that you're
right.
putting down.
And it just doesn't, you know, we're not sure where it's going yet.
They pad out the theme song, you know, the writers are phoning it in. It's a lot of fun.
Great.
So
I love the Desilu Productions version of this game. Now, in and of itself, it would play as a good Star Trek game.
I think
fast.
So.
If you like the series and you recognize it, it's even better. But playing it as the Desilu Productions gives it that extra level of interest and humor.
And humor, definitely.
And humor. I mean, it's you can't play the Desilu Production version of this game, you know, without using the gravelly voice and chewing on the cigar.
That's right. And so when you play it this way, I think it becomes a light, fun game for Star Trek geeks. I like it a lot. The artwork on the cards is really nice. They're all very clear screen captures from the show. Some of the cards look like little old show tricorders.
Like tricorders, you're looking on the screen of the tricorder or
and
the view screen.
The mission plot and discovery cards look like parts of the view screen on the bridge, which is really cool.
Right.
And when you put them together,
you get
the whole view screen. And yeah, the cards are well laid out. They have nice icons, and they're easy to understand.
Now, how long did this game go? I mean, how complete are these?
Is one of the downsides of this game is that it the first set of cards only covers the first season of the show. So these are only characters and challenges and episodes from season one of the old show.
So
no Spock's brain.
No Spock's brain.
Because that was the third season, unfortunately. There was an expansion set called Starfleet Maneuvers, which covered the second season. I've been searching for it for a while, though, and I've not been able to find any cards of it available anywhere.
Much more rare than the first set.
Apparently so. But the first set of boosters and starters are readily available. So where can we get this game today? eBay, of course. There's boxes. They still are going at about 10. You need at least one starter to play this game. You can't just buy a box of boosters because you need the rule book and
you need
the cards for the big three, which only come in the starters. You need the default mission, the default episode cards. And if you can't find it on eBay, there's a site called cardhouse.com, HAUS, and they sell booster boxes for $9, but you're still going to need a starter somewhere.
Right. Wow. And, you know, just for the people out there, I'm looking here at the rule book, and the rule book is pretty well put together, and it's nice. It's a little dense. I could have used...
I don't think it's that well put together. It took me a little while to fully understand the rules.
Understand it. Yeah. It's also only about, like, 2 inches large, and so you...
Well, it's one of those standard CCG rule books where you're looking at this little tiny booklet that's...
I wouldn't have designed it this way. No, but my favorite part is at the very back part of the rule book. It says, you know, once you get this game, send it now, and if you subscribe to this magazine, they will give you a free exclusive game card to go with the game, and the game card is Shirtless Kirk.
And, you know, if I had only sent that in when this game was still in print, I could have got the Shirtless Kirk card.
The exclusive, rare Shirtless Kirk, and it's there he is standing in his...
his Starfleet issue spandex bottoms and without a shirt. And, you know, I'm the farthest thing from gay, but boy, I want that card.
We'll have to tell the look at your butt people about this one.
We will. We'll tell the look at your butt people.
Look at his butt.
Look at his butt.
That's what
right?
it was called.
Look at his butt.
I think this picture is from Charlie X, actually. I even know what episode that was from,
right.
Where they were working out in the gym.
That's right.
So, yeah, so for about $20 for a box of boosters and a box of starters, I've got more cards for this game than I know what to do with. I have plenty to make several decent decks, but...
You could decoupage your dining room table with the ones that you're not using.
I could. Maybe I will. But, you know, even if I don't make good decks, sometimes we just like to take a random bunch of cards and just play those as our decks, and it's still a lot of fun.
Yeah, and it's a fast-moving, fun sort of game. I mean, I would rate it as anywhere near one of the fun, easy card games like Shea Geek or something that's...
Or Munchkin,
or
something
Munchkin,
like that.
Something easy to pick up. Now, one little caveat is I bet if I played this with a non-Star Trek fan, they would not think it was nearly as funny or interesting. Because
that's very true.
Because they would look at the different plot things, and they're like, so why is that weird that the Romulan is here on the mining colony? And we'd go, oh, but see, he never was there. And they would hate it. So they wouldn't hate it. They would still be able to play the game and get along fine. But it's that extra level, that extra flavor and level of excitement that comes from being a fan that makes the game interesting.
Yes, they would only be able to enjoy it as a game. And I don't think I don't know if it's strong enough as a game to be super fun.
Right.
I think when you add the extra level of being a Star Trek game, I think that makes it that much more fun.
Right.
So that is Star Trek the card game from FLIR Skybox.
Yeah, it's a CCG that is not being used as a CCG. Thank you for listening to another show of Roll 2D6.
We'll be back in 2D6 days, possibly 2D6 weeks.
Can we get that down to 1D8 weeks?
More like 1D8 plus 20.
Oh, man.
I should have called this podcast something else.
And so until next time, we wish you success with all of your saving throws.
See you next time.